Welcome to episode 178 of the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. This week, we start a multi-episode series to walk you through the February 2009 Hokkaido workshop and photography tour. As I mentioned last week, the workshop went very well again, with a few things that didn't go according to plan, but most which did and were great fun. And everyone had a whole bunch of great photos when they came back. Let's just jump right into it and take a look at 10 images from the first day today. Welcome to episode 178 of the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. This week, we start a multi-episode series to walk you through the February 2009 Hokkaido workshop and photography tour. As I mentioned last week, the workshop went very well again, with a few things that didn't go according to plan, but most which did and were great fun. And everyone had a whole bunch of great photos when they came back. Let's just jump right into it and take a look at 10 images from the first day today. Now, I should say to start off with that I don't intend to do one episode for each of the 9 days of the tour, so don't worry about that. Some days, though, just warrant a single episode because there were so many things to shoot and talk about. The first day of the tour was February the 16th, 2009, and we'd met at Haneda Airport in Tokyo to head out to Hokkaido and start shooting for the first day. It seems that as much as I try, on the first day of any time I go to Hokkaido, not just for these workshops, but also privately, I often end up doing something silly or hurting myself. I remember like losing memory cards on the beach, or I've mentioned that before, I won't go into details now. And also one time, pretty much as soon as I got there, all of the excitement of being back in Hokkaido, and I slipped down a bank and cut my trousers and knee open and everything. And I've just done silly things a number of times on the first day. And, like I say, I won't go into details, but I did something really silly again on the first day. And it was worrying, actually, because obviously I'm responsible for all of the people that are joining me there. But as soon as I got on the plane, I went to put my bag in the overhead compartment, and I caught the weight of my bag a little bit sort of funnily and briefly dislocated my thumb. And luckily, as soon as I felt it pop out, I took the weight off of the thumb and off the bag, and it popped straight back in again. But there was some damage done, and it swelled up a little bit, and I was a bit worried on the plane on the way out there. But I put some cold pads on it for the first few nights, and it was okay after that. I could use it after like 3 days, and then it just hurt, and it still hurts now, actually, over 3 weeks later. But it's just about sorted out. But I definitely tore something, and so that sort of jinx thing on the first day was right back. But I was also kind of I was kind of relieved as well because of that jinx thing. And I thought, well, at least I've got it out of the way and I know what's going to happen now. So I could just sort of settle down for the flight and spend time with the other participants. I'd asked everyone to come for the, come to the airport for the flight dressed for the day in the warm clothing, or at least with anything that they needed to get out of their bag on the top of the bag. So we didn't need to sort of get changed. We spent quite a long time. I didn't make this clear on the first trip, and we spent quite a long time for the 2008 trip, getting people changed and stuff and getting ready. This year we met ready to go out on the snow, and apart from one mishap where one of the guys left his passport in the luggage cart at the airport, and then we had to go back for that. We hit the snow sort of middle of the morning. I think it was, I didn't make a note, but I think it was around 10:30 to 11 a.m. when we actually got to the crane center. With, there always being so much to shoot on this workshop, we don't really get time to do any practical study in the field. I do spend a lot of time walking around and making sure that everyone's okay and checking people's settings, not making them show me, just making sure that everyone is happy and they've got the settings done as they want. I spend a certain amount of time helping people with the customization of the camera and everything in the field. But, you know, basically, because there is so much to shoot, I tend to spend the time on the bus explaining to people what's going to happen when we get there, you know, what's going to happen. And then what's, you know, the shooting conditions, what they need to take care of and all of that. So, you know, it just is really too difficult once we get into a place to get everyone back together, you know, like, because we all sort of spread out and start to find places to that we want to shoot. I don't want to be standing next to each other or we'll all end up with exactly the same shots. So people do tend to spread out a little bit. And even if I do start talking to people, either individually or a few at a time, you know, we find that something happens, you know, in the scene. Some birds start honking or, you know, something starts to happen and everyone just jumps straight back to the gear and continue shooting. So, you know, because of this, I really do spend a lot of time instead of out in the field, on the bus, between locations or like nights before, things like that, preparing everyone for the shoot that we're going to have. And, you know, then we sort of build on this as necessary with each individual in the field. And generally, you know, I set up my gear too so that I can not only get into the zone, as they say, as well as getting some pictures for myself, of course. But I also need to be shooting to understand the conditions and sort of make myself aware of anything that I need to let the participants know so that I can sort of get the best possible shots while there too. Of course, I imagine that as the numbers increase, my ability to do this is going to drop considerably. But for now, it's possible without any detriment to the overall tour. On the first day, the most apparent thing that we had to deal with was that there was a patchy cloud that was making the exposure relatively difficult. Aperture priority or shutter priority simply don't work with the cranes because they move from a pure white background of the snow to a very dark, almost totally black background. And then sometimes a split of the two very quickly and very often. Trying to keep up with exposure compensation in conditions like this is pretty much impossible. So I get the group shooting in manual mode as soon as possible, if they don't already, of course. Both this year and last year, it took some time for the necessity for this to sink in. But usually after the first day or so, everyone's in agreement that it's the only way to go. Basically, if you're not in manual mode, every time the white crane jumps up in the air or flies, and the brightness of the background changes, the camera's meter will get all confused and overexpose the cranes considerably. Say if you were set up to shoot them against a white background and they go to a dark background. And I've spoken about this a number of times over the years, so I won't go into detail. If you don't understand, either listen to the previous related podcasts or sign up for next year's workshop. I'll be releasing details on how to do that very soon as well, hopefully. Anyway, to get back to what I was talking about, on this first day, there's a lot of patchy cloud, which means that although manual is still the only way to go, you have to keep your eye on the light conditions constantly. When the sun was fully out, we were shooting at around a 1,250th of a second to a 1,600th of a second at ISO 100 with an aperture of 5.6. But then when the sun went behind the cloud, we'd have to reduce the shutter speed to around 1,640th or even a 500th of a second. And so this means that there was a good 1 1/3 or so stops of difference in the amount of light that we were shooting with. So we had to constantly keep our minds on the weather and, you know, where the sun was in the sky, you know, not so much where it was in the sky, but whether it was behind clouds or, you know, in front of them and you know, shining down nicely for us. And so we just had to keep switching between the two extremes of exposure, making the manual adjustments most of the time to the shutter speed. The good thing is that the two extremes were pretty predictable. So, you know, for most of the day at least, all we had to do was to just, you know, if you were at f5.6 at 1,640th and then the sun came out, you know that you just have to go back to 1/1250th or 1600th, then you can do that relatively quickly, as long as you're keeping your eyes out and your mind on the fact that you have to do that. One option, of course, and I have heard people give this advice, even at the crane centre that we were at on the first day, is to simply shoot them all a little bit underexposed and then bump up the exposure in post-processing. But I personally don't subscribe to that way of shooting. If you do this, you'll end up with muddy and grainy blacks, and it looks pretty horrible. If you don't care about that, you can go ahead. But you know, my idea is just to try and get it right in camera. You know, that mantra of getting it right in the field or getting it right in camera is pretty much something that I always stick to. And you know, it will just generally get you the best results, even if you have to constantly keep your eye on your exposure. You do sometimes blow out the odd highlight, or sometimes, you know, it turns out a little bit dark because you didn't notice the light shift, or it happened right in the middle of a piece of action. But in those cases, as long as you are shooting in RAW, you can usually rescue the image. Really badly blown out highlights is difficult, but a little bit, and you can get away with that. And this will result, of course, in lower quality images. But if something's worth saving, then go for it. Aiming for the best is the real goal here, and you know, the most important thing is just trying to keep that in mind. And if we can fall back on the technology as necessary when things don't go 100% the way we'd like them to, then so be it. Let's take a look at some images now, though. So you know, to see what we were shooting and what I mean about the exposure, first let's look at image number 2107. This is a pair of cranes coming into land at the Akan International Crane Centre. You can see here that I have the perfect bright whites, still though with lots of detail in the dark black the feathers that you can see around the you know, the crane's neck and along the back of their wings. If I was to rely on brightening them up in post-processing and not shooting to the right shoulder of the histogram, you know, shooting for the highlights, as they say, then this detail would simply not be there in the blacks. I'd be able to pull some detail out, but it would end up grainy and muddy, and it just wouldn't look nice. So this is really what I'm talking about. I like the overall symmetry here with the, maybe not symmetry, but like, you know, the fact that we've got the back crane in almost the same position as the foreground crane. I shot this at 1/2000th of a second at f4.5 with ISO 100. I was using the 600mm f4 lens for this, as the cranes were at a distance. It's important when shooting the cranes and the eagles later, later today and later in the week, to have two camera bodies, one with your long lens on and another with a wider lens. I find that the 70-200mm range is pretty it's perfect for this this wider lens most of the time. I have shot with an even wider. I've shot with the 24-105 in this, you know, in this way a number of times, and that works as well. But I generally like the 70-200 for this second body, over the shoulder sort of thing. And you know, we can see why in image number 2111. As the cranes fly out of the crane centre, they sometimes fly right over your head, as this one did, and they're very close. This image was shot at 70mm, which is of course the widest end of the 70-200mm at f2.8 lens. Now, this is one of those shots that I just couldn't throw out because of the perfect detail in the underside of the bird. You know, when you zoom in, it's just amazing. And there's actually even a catch light in the eye there that you can see from below. The exposure was perfect too, as I was just sort of keeping on top of that. And, you know, what the problem is here, the reason that I was tempted but couldn't throw it out, was that I actually cropped this very close to the end of the bird's beak in the camera. There was like, I don't know, about 10 pixels or so after the bird's beak, and then it was the edge of the frame. So, you know, There was one slightly before this, I think it was, that was better framed, but it was a little bit soft. As I'd, what I'd done is I'd been panning vertically as this as the bird flew up above me, and I'd literally, as I panned upwards, I'd craned, no pun intended, but I'd craned my back right over, and was literally starting to bend over backwards now to get this shot. And so I was simply at my extreme physically, and the bird started to go out of the frame. But this was the best shot. And so what I did was I extended the canvas in Photoshop by around 15% and then just cloned the sky from the top edge of the image to extend it out to the edge of the canvas. And so, you know, a little bit of cheating here, depending on how you look at it. And I probably wouldn't have done this years ago, but I'm kind of okay with it now. And, you know, to save something that I think is otherwise a good shot, I'm pretty happy to do that now. As the number of cranes gradually grows, which is a good thing, of course, as they almost died out in Hokkaido a number of decades ago. One problem that we face now when shooting them at places like the crane center is that it's difficult to get a clear shot of just one or two cranes. The, you know, the cranes sometimes are, they start honking and doing the mating dance with their partner, and sometimes just do a sort of a dance with the whole family. But whatever, you know, including just those, the cranes that are doing the dance and the honking and stuff, is sometimes pretty difficult. It can be, you know, really tough getting them alone. What it depends on is really where you're standing and just the look of the draw. But then also you need a pretty long lens to single them out, or you're going to be doing a lot of cropping, which is maybe okay. You know, it depends how big you want to use the image. But you know, because there are only a certain number of free spaces along the edge of the viewing area, when you're shooting with a long lens and you have to get it leveled, you don't really want to be uprooting yourself and running around trying to find another space when things like this start happening. So, you know, you can really just count it as luck. You've got to be in the right place for some of them, and you're not going to get a shot at all of these things. So anyway, sometimes you do get a clear, what I call a through shot. So let's take a look at some of mine that I was quite pleased with. The first one is image number 2115. I followed these two birds as they maneuvered through the crowd of birds. And in fact, I won't include the image, but you can see another very close to this in the gallery that I shot of these same two birds 15 seconds earlier as they started to sort of honk in unison. And at the time they were walking with their backs to me, but I'd also got a nice clear shot of those these two for that as well. That in itself is a nice shot. As I tracked their movement, though, they turned to each other and started to cross each other, you know, from my perspective. And this is one of my favorite crane photos, as it shows both the tufted, you know, it looks like a tail on the right bird. I'll get into that in a moment. But, you know, you've got that black tuft on the back of the bird on the right. But also shows you the wings of the left bird sort of raised upwards, showing us that, you know, what usually looks like that black tufted tail, but it's actually not a tail at all. It's the back edge of the wings, the crane's wings. And we can see here that the Japanese Red Crown crane's tail is actually pure white. And, you know, I've tested a number of people on this, asking them about, you ask most people here what color is a Red Crown crane's tail, and they'll pretty much all tell you it's black. And that's because of, you know, when they see the pictures of them with, like the one on the right here, for some reason, the black feathers along the back of the wings kind of tufted up like that and look very much like a tail. But it's actually not, but it's pretty deceiving. We can also see the shape of the bird's body very well in this image. Looks a little bit like a turkey, actually, with those drumsticks there. And one of the things that I've tried to capture many times and only been partially successful, and on this time it's not really, really good, but You can see that I've got some of the breath coming out of the bird's mouth there, and it's slightly white against the dark background. For me, everything worked in this image, so I was really pleased that I got a clear shot of just the two birds. I continued to shoot, of course, as they moved, and they crossed over, and I got another one that I'm happy with, and that is image number 2116. Overall, I prefer the last shot, but in this image, we have that wonderful symmetry in the legs, and almost a symmetrical pose with the crossing over at the knees. And both birds are sort of, they have their necks arched backwards, making a kind of a wine glass shape. It's not perfect though. And so, I think in my mind, the one that we just looked at before this is the better of the shots. But both of them were shot at f5.6 with ISO 100 and a shutter speed of 1/640th of a second. And I was again using the 600mm f4 lens. Let's move on to a more documentary shot now, which is image number 2118. Here you can see that we have at least seven cranes in the background of this image. There's one in the foreground eating a fish that has just been thrown out for the cranes. This shows just how crowded the place is with cranes, and hopefully helps you to appreciate how difficult it is to get a nice clear shot of just a single pair. It also shows that the cranes are fed fish for a few reasons. One reason is to help the cranes just feed themselves, to get food. The cranes were dwindling in their numbers due to human encroachment into their breeding and feeding grounds for many years, and that's still the case to a degree. But then a few organisations, I went into detail on this a little in last year's roundup of the workshop, so I'm not going to go into detail again today. But a few individuals started to set land aside for them to feed on and to actually be a place to feed them. They don't feed them much, and if you watch, I'd say they probably throw like one fish out for every five or six cranes. It's not as if they're throwing a lot out there. So they don't actually all get a belly full of fish at feeding time. But what that does is, it brings us to the other reason for them feeding them. And that is really to ensure that the cranes come back to this same spot. And that's not just because it's a safe place for them to be, but also because it helps to attract another not so rare species called the photographer. Photographias, as they're known in academic circles, have a number of subspecies or genus, and there's a couple with names like the Wildliferus or the Naturalis photographias, and these thrive on images of rare and beautiful creatures like the majestic red-crowned cranes, so it's kind of a symbiotic relationship. The fish also attract other birds such as the white-tailed eagle and the Stella sea eagle, and we can see a white-tailed eagle making off with one of the fish in image number 2120. I cropped this image across the top and the bottom a little to narrow the path of the bird out of the image, which I thought worked pretty well for this, probably partly because of the shape of the snowy bank with the trees, the bank in the trees in the background. Of the image there, as well as the arch made by the eagle's wings. I just kind of like that sort of boomerang shape that we got there. To capture the action, I'd changed to ISO 200 now and was shooting with a shutter speed of 1/1600th of a second, still at f5.6. Let's move on to image number 2121 now. After the feeding, the cranes start to make their way out of the crane centre, sometimes in pretty large numbers, as we can see here. Again, I've cropped this image a little to keep focus on the birds. I cropped along the top and I think a little along the bottom, if I remember rightly. And also, it wasn't a lot, but I think I cropped about 5% or so off the left side too, to balance it out so that we've got a similar amount of space on the right and the left sides between the edge, the cranes at the edge and the edge of the image. This again is another reason to have a second body with a wider lens on. And it's also, you know, a good sort of example of why I do like the 70-200 rather than a shorter telephoto. And that's because, you know, I'd got the 70-200 on the 5D Mark II here, and I was shooting at 200 millimeters this time. So, you know, the one that we looked at earlier where it was right above my head was at 70, this is at 200. And you can see that you get a good use for this for the 70-200 in this location. I was still at ISO 200. I was shooting with a shutter speed of 800th of a second now, though, due to the cloudy sky, and I was still at f5.6. The birds are heading off to a nearby river to roost, which is where we're hoping to shoot the birds in the mist the following morning. There's, you know, this location, the river is about 40 minutes or so away, but also near to there, maybe 30 to 40 minutes from the Akan Crane Center, there's a kindly farmer or farm owner who's set aside a field for the cranes to stop off if they want. And also, it's an area for that he's allowed people, you know, photographers to basically park their cars or, you know, just hang out there and set up their gear and wait for the cranes to fly overhead. There's no power lines for the most part, which is somewhat rare in Japanese countryside, at least in the towns, you know, because they don't bury power lines very much here. But there's a good patch of sky where you can get a nice clear shot at the birds. And, you know, shortly after shooting this image that we were just looking at, we were going to head over to this place, to this farmer's land, and start to wait for the birds to fly over on their way to the roost. Before we go, though, let's take a look at one last shot from the Crane Center for today, which is image number 2122. Another animal that makes his way to the center at feeding time is the fox, as we can see here. The crows are everywhere in Japan, and so not particularly worth talking about. They can they can often be a nuisance. But here I just kind of like the play with the nice sharp fox and then the out of focus crow. But then with the cranes behind them, you know, sort of, and then you've got the fox with his glare firmly focused on the crow. And you can't help thinking, you know, that he's got no way, you know, because of course foxes will attack. They'll get into chicken runs and they'll eat the chickens. And I'm sure this guy is thinking that, you know, he could just sort of, you know, clear the plate with that crow there and just, you know, maybe eat it without much hesitation. And then, of course, you know, we've got the cranes behind, and these things are just huge. They're like 160 centimeters tall. And so, you know, they would not have any, you know, although it's another bird, he'd have no chance of trying to attack one of those. They'd probably just poke his eyes out with those beaks. And if you remember, you know, they can lose their patience with the smaller critters that come in here. And if you remember from last year's shoot, I had a great shot of one of the juvenile cranes stomping on a white-tailed eagle that got in a little bit too close trying to steal the fish. And so, you know, they don't have a lot of patience with these critters. So it's just a weird sort of play that we have here with the cranes in the background and then the crow with the fox just sort of, you know, wandering around looking for opportunity. So we headed over to the place that I was talking about a moment ago. It's called the Kikuchi Farm, and this is a place where you can basically shoot the flyover as the cranes make their way to the roost. And it was there that I got image number 2123. This is shot, you know, it's very much something that I could have done at the last location. It's not dissimilar to one of the first ones we looked at. But you'll notice here that there's much warmer light on the underside of the crane's wings. And it's basically as the sun gets low in the sky. It's almost on the horizon here. But the light on the underside of the wings is very warm. And so just a slight different touch to a similar sort of image. It also makes for a stunning blue sky, almost shocking blue, as a backdrop for this image. Shot at ISO 200, I was still at f5.6 with a shutter speed of 1/320th of a second as the light dies at the end of the day. Finally, for today, we're going to finish with a slightly played with shot, and that is image number 2124. So, getting very experimental here for me, and in the spirit of being totally open about what I'm doing, there are a few things that I wanted to talk about. Firstly, I got two shots of this scene that I liked, where the cranes in relation to the tree were in a relatively nice position. The first shot had the tree slightly blurred as I was panning with the cranes, which is I'm accepting that as acceptable. But the cranes were a little bit too blurred, and the second shot I had really sharp cranes in, but the trees were a little bit too blurred. So basically what I did was open them both up as layers in Photoshop, which you can do now if you select two images or multiple images in Lightroom and then right click to edit. Then one of the options is to open as layers in Photoshop. Basically that's what I did, open them up and then just sort of used a mask to graph the birds from the sharp birds from the one shot into the tree with the less blurred trees, the shot with the less blurred trees. Basically I'm merging two images together here. Again, this is something that I'd never have done a few years ago, but I'm pushing the boat out a little bit here these days. The second thing that I did was to add a coloured gradation filter to warm up the bottom half of the shot. And, I just really wanted to get a little bit more of an enhanced sort of after sunset red glow in the sky there. There was one, the sun had not long gone down, and that's really what I got the idea from, but I just wanted to enhance it a little bit more. So I used the gradation filter in Lightroom and selected the colour and picked a colour that looked a little bit like the colour that was there originally, but just enhanced it a little bit and dragged it up to about halfway through the shot. And that's, the result is what you see here. And, here again, I was kind of, I'm still not that comfortable with doing this sort of stuff, I'm having fun and sort of thinking to myself that this is something that I used to do back in the film days with, I used to have a warm red and an orange graduated filter, and I could drop them over the lens and do that while shooting. And so I'm kind of justifying that to myself. Whether you do it or not, obviously that's up to you. And like I say, I probably would never have done this a few years ago myself either. So, I'm just sort of coming to terms with all of this sort of stuff. But anyway, I quite liked the end results, so I thought we'd finish with that one for today. So that was the first day of the Winter Wonderland Workshop from February 16th to 24th, 2009. As I said earlier, I don't intend to do an entire episode for every day, but some days just seem to warrant it. Join me again next week as we pick up the trail at the beginning of the second day, when we are hoping for calm weather with temperatures of minus 15 degrees Celsius or below, so that we can get that beautiful frost on the trees and the mist on the river that we had last year. You'll have to come back next week to see how that turned out. For now, you have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye. The Martin Bailey Photography Podcast is a proud member of the Photocast Network. Find this and other great photography podcasts at photocastnetwork.com.